KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Welcome to The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular feature on Indigenous food news. I'm Andy Murphy. President Trump's spending plan would slash billions of dollars from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, potentially bumping thousands of Native Americans out of eligibility. The administration's push to increase timber production also has some tribes worried about the wild foods in forests targeted for logging. And future chefs are among the Native graduating class of 2025. We're back after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Juneau, Alaska School District is expanding its support of a local language immersion program. After multiple meetings and extended debate, the school board has agreed to fund more of the Tlingit Language Immersion Program in the upcoming school year, even amid statewide school budgeting concerns. KTOO's Yvonne Krumrie reports.
The program in question is Atkuaha, Expanding the Tlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program, or TCLL. The school district and the nonprofit arm of a regional Native corporation have historically roughly split the cost. The school board signed a memorandum of agreement Wednesday with the Alaska Heritage Institute to increase its investment in the project. But school board members brought up questions about whether the district should pay for more of the TCLL program amidst widespread concerns about funding. Board member Elizabeth Sidden said the school supports TCLL, but they have to balance that with the needs of the entire district.
But we support it amongst how we support all of our 4,000 students. So I'm trying to keep in mind that these 119 are not the only students we're responsible for.
The school board initially approved the change during its budget process. They were then under the impression that the grant SHI used for the program was ending, according to the school board president. But SHI was later approved for an extension of the grant. The program isn't growing, but now the school district will fund 8 of its 11 positions. And the change requires additional funding from the school district's budget. SHI Education Director Christy Ford said the program is intended to increase the number of Tlingit language speakers.
We have less than 10 fluent speakers left, so the need and the urgency to put intensive amount of support and instruction into the TCLL program was asked of us.
In recent meetings, some school board members said the program only serves a small percentage of Juneau students. But Ford said the scope is intentional. It's intense and immersive, so that there's a group of dedicated speakers to make sure the Tlingit language doesn't go extinct. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Krumrie.
Montana's Native families face higher rates of separation with a disproportionate number of Native kids in foster care. A nonprofit in Lodgegrass is developing a center aimed at keeping tribal families together and out of social services. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Trexler has more.
Mountain Shadow Association recently began construction of a family healing center to support communities on the Crow Reservation. Executive Director Megan Doyle explains addiction and behavioral health issues can break apart families. She says children from the reservation are often sent to foster care families out of state when these issues arise. The center, called Kala's Village, aims to change that.
That's what Kala's Village is really trying to do, is provide this consistent and constant relationship and connection, and to help repair those places where connection and relationship are broken.
The center's approach is based in restorative justice, which aims to address the root cause of crimes instead of incarceration. Doyle says they hope to break cycles of abuse and trauma. Kala's Village was developed from years of direct dialogue between the nonprofit and Lodgegrass community members.
They really wanted it to be a safe place for them and for their children. And they also wanted to make sure that they were going to be surrounded by people who shared similar goals with them in recovery. So
the 13-acre campus will have housing along with a preschool and caretakers to help supervise the children. Doyle says they hope to fully open by the end of 2026. In Missoula, I'm Victoria Traxler.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is The Menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food sovereignty. I'm your host, Andy Murphy. With more than 100 million additional acres of federal forest land opening up for logging, the Nez Perce and other tribes are concerned about what the effect will be on fish and wildlife habitat that is a source for food. We'll hear from tribal wildlife officials about that. But it's still graduation season, and we'll acknowledge the hard work of Native Culinary Arts graduates at Navajo Technical University. They're now equipped with skills to manage kitchens or food programs or even start their own food businesses. But first, President Trump's big, beautiful bill. It passed the U.S. House and is in the Senate right now, and it has significant cuts in store for SNAP, the low-income food assistance program. We'll talk about what this means for Native Americans, and you can join our conversation too with your comments and questions. Call 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Fayetteville, Arkansas, is Kelly Case. She's a staff attorney for the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative. She's a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Welcome to The Menu, Kelly.
Chuck Ma, so good to be with you today.
Thank you for joining. So around $300 billion will be cut from SNAP in the span of 10 years. What does that mean in the immediate future, and what are the long-term effects too?
Absolutely. So I'll start with just a little bit of information about the impact of SNAP in Indian country broadly. We know that about a quarter of Native households are dealing with food insecurity. We also know that Indian country largely overlaps with rural America. Because of these two things, programs like SNAP are a major factor in meeting the nutritional needs that exist in these households and also helping as an economic driver and job creator in these rural areas, not only for, you know, your local tribal C-store that might be a SNAP vendor, but also with the farmers and ranchers working in those areas who get to participate in this program and work directly with program participants at places like farmers markets. So this particular program plays a huge role in Indian country for those two reasons and many others. The language in the bill sets forth several proposed changes. A lot of those are liable to impact access to the program all across Indian country. I can give you the breakdown of each one of them, but I know we're on a tight timeline. So
all right. Yeah.
Some of the major changes that you'll see in this, you can think about changes to the Thrifty Food Plan proposed in the bill, which the Thrifty Food Plan is a plan used to determine what the benefits to a household participating in SNAP will be. These changes to the Thrifty Food Plan would kind of freeze that in place and limit the amount of changes in the Thrifty Food Plan or adjustments over time as well. Also, a handful of changes to work requirements And a big consideration here is the matching funding and administrative cost share changes. So under current law, you can think of this funding in sort of two buckets. For running SNAP, there's, you know, the cost of running a program that a state government might have to handle. So staffing, all the other things like that. Current law says that the federal government puts up 50% of the cost for that administrative burden, and the state puts up 50% of that cost. Under the proposed language, that would shift, and rather than a half and half match, it would be the states putting up 75% for that purpose, while the federal government meets 25% of that need. So an immediate shift in the cost for a state to run the program that way. Also, there's the cost of the food, right? So what does it cost to purchase those or use those benefits? Presently, there is no state requirement of matching funds for those food benefits. However, the proposed shift would be that each state would be required to pay at minimum 5% of those benefit costs starting in 2028. However, what the total percentage each state would pay would vary over time based on their historical error rates, right, which is calculated as under and over payments throughout the program. So that cost share could shift from anywhere from 5% to 25% over that period of time, again, increasing the cost to these state agencies to run the program. There are a number of ways that could impact, and states are going to have to deal with that in a number of ways. Tough to predict how any one situation would shake out, but pretty clear that states might respond by changing their eligibility criteria or their benefit levels, which could impact broadly folks' ability to access this program.
Okay. And SNAP is, you know, a huge program. Do we know about how many Native people take advantage of this program, or is it hard to track these kinds of statistics?
They can be a little tougher to track, and do typically break different ways state by state. But again, to meet that quarter of Native households being food insecure need, there are a ton of Native households that are making use of this program.
Okay. All right. And what are some long-term effects, say in 10 years, do you think this program will be as widely used as it is now?
Yeah. So longer-term effects, I think you'll see some of the immediate possibilities continue, right? So a lack of access to this program, and it has the potential to exacerbate some of the existing issues that are out there in Indian country, places where possibly, and there's a variety all over, but places where you may not have a ton of access to stores, right? But maybe your stores are utilizing SNAP benefit income as a major part of their business planning and their ability to continue to hire a certain amount of folks from the community and continue to run their business. So if this goes away, so do those stores, small stores, places in rural areas which are using this as their economic driver. Additionally, we have this concerning stat about Native households facing food insecurity. That could be exacerbated by removing their ability to access these programs. An additional thing we see is that SNAP doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? There are other nutrition programs that play a role across Indian country, and they exist in conversation with one another, particularly things like the food distribution program on Indian reservations. Those programs cannot be used in the same month. And historically, we've seen instances where people transition between programs to access the best benefit for their family and their household during that month. Also, if they have the opportunity to switch. So thanks to centuries of federal Indian policy around removal and relocation, we know that not all tribal citizens live on reservation anymore or live within the tribal jurisdictions that might be able to serve them through something like the food distribution program. So twofold, in instances where folks lose access to SNAP, they may be in a place where they can turn to their tribal government to try to fill that gap. That will mean additional man hours, food procurement efforts from tribal governments to make sure their citizens and their communities are continuing to be fed. That can also mean for those citizens that cannot turn to their tribal government because they are outside of the service area or jurisdiction, they will lose access to both programs in some instances. Meaning, again, we're seeing an exacerbation of those existing food security and rural development issues.
Okay. So folks could also turn to other food programs, food pantries, and there's a lot of groups out there that focus on food insecurity, but they also are going to be dealing with cuts in the future. Can you tell about that? Or they're dealing with cuts right now. Can you tell us about that and sort of the fate of that option too?
Yeah. Again, as I mentioned earlier, these programs and these changes don't exist in a vacuum. They absolutely impact one another. So changes to one program might cause folks to seek out other resources like the food banks and other organizations that you mentioned. However, if they're both handling cuts at this time and trying to navigate that process, it means they do not necessarily have the resources to fill that need. In those instances, if everybody's got cuts to have to work through, right, there may not be enough organizational support or food to meet that gap in nutrition needs for Indian Country or across the country for that matter. I think you see a lot of people now looking to find creative solutions for how to meet this need as it's developing over time.
Okay. There are SNAP eligibility criteria has changed a little here and there over the years, but what are some proposed changes from the administration you're hearing about?
Yeah, so specifically in this language the language that we're talking about today is the able-bodied adults without dependents requirements that you'll see. So those able-bodied adults without dependents, the current work requirements are for certain adults between 18 and 54 who don't have dependents are required to work or attend training programs for about 80 hours a month to receive those SNAP benefits over a certain period of time. The proposed change would expand that age range to 18 through 64.
Okay.
And for dependent children who are over the age of 7 rather than over the age of 18. So.
Okay. All right. We'll be back after this break. This is The Menu on Native America Calling. Matthew Fletcher puts pieces of his and his family's life into a collection of 12 short stories that revolve around modern Native American experiences. Fletcher is a well-known expert in Native law, but turns to fiction in his latest creative work. We'll add Stick Houses to our Native bookshelf on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian Country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're talking about how Trump administration directives would affect the habitat that supports indigenous food. The president enacted an immediate expansion of timber production on federal land. How will increased logging in national forest land near your Native community affect your access to indigenous food? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Lapway, Idaho is Eric Hult. He is the chairman of the Nez Perce Tribe Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's Nez Perce. Welcome back to The Menu, Eric.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I want to set the scene a little bit. I was looking at the map of the Department of Interior highlighting the national forest land that is opened up for logging. And it looks like much of Idaho and the land around the Nez Perce Reservation is now available for commercial logging. What is your understanding of what changes under this emergency directive from the Trump administration?
Thank you for the question. And, you know, as complex as it sounds, you know, it's just as we've been seeing in the first 120 plus days of the new administration in terms of the degradation of the protection measures that are in place from these various agencies that we count upon, you know, that have trust responsibilities to our peoples and to the lands and the lands that we're stewards of. And so having, you know, those protection measures taken away, you know, and are, you know, basically, you know, obsolete now as you look forward and seeing all the slashes that have been happening under the DOGE activities. And so we're seeing it here locally as well, where we're seeing the long-term employees that were a part of the government-to-government relationship, you know, those things have, you know, somewhat diminished in terms of the longevity of our partnerships that we've had in the relationship building over time. And then knowing that, you know, with the administration, you know, eliminating a lot of those positions that we relied upon, and then having us to, you know, one, in the short term is, you know, who are we going to be speaking to? Who's going to be speaking on behalf of this? You know, and we know from our Toowoomba, our, you know, sacred laws that we speak on behalf of those first foods and those that can't speak for themselves. So, you know, that's why it's so important for us as we see the you know, demolishing of those protection and those different agencies that would provide that for us, you know, and then also things like NEPA and EIS, you know, those sort of things that give us that review process timing to look at something real comprehensive, as such as these logging operations, where now you see them being streamlined to fast track them to, you know, into fruition, and then without very little collaboration or any sort of, you know, offering from the tribes to, you know, offset some of the things that we know are going to be impacting our, not only the area itself and the landscape, but there's a lot of other residual things that are going to be affected in far more ways than, you know, what they're wanting to take into consideration before they start these projects.
Okay. And I want to ask you about some of those residual effects a little bit, but I wanted to ask about the forest land around the Nez Perce Reservation. Just a moment ago, I mentioned the Department of Interior issued a map that highlighted the forest land that is now opened up to logging, and looks like the Nez Perce Reservation is surrounded by all that land now opened up for logging. Can you talk about the forest land around the Nez Perce Reservation?
Yes, and I thank you for that. And, you know, we're tied hand in hand with the Clearwater Nez Perce National Forest. And, you know, and so that's one of the things where, you know, the Nez Perce National Forest, you know, proudly gets its name from the people who have called this place home for thousands of generations. That's the Nez Perce Indians. You know, we call ourselves Nimiipuu. We the people, you know, and so the land itself, you know, as you know, the Nez Perce leaders ceded the original territory to the government in 1855 and through the 1863 treaties. And, you know, but we didn't relinquish our rights to hunt, fish, gather, or to practice traditional religious or ceremonial cultural ceremonies on our ancestral homeland. And today, the USDA Forest Service manages much of that ceded territory, as you stated. And, you know, we still maintain strong ties to the homelands, and we do that through not only our, you know, our ceremonies as such, but through work cooperatively, and especially as stewards of the precious forest resources. You know, those are the things that are really important to us. And, you know, and on top of that, Congress passed laws giving the Nez Perce tribe and other tribes status as sovereign governments. And so along with those treaties, the subsequent laws and regulations direct the Forest Service and other federal entities to carefully manage treaty-reserved resources and rights. And so when we talk about our, you know, our tribal council and, you know, all the resource specialists and things, or technical people a part of our tribe, you know, we ensure that our programs, projects, and policies do have a negative impact. And so that's why we want this collaboration to take place within the ceded territories, because we lose that because, they, you know, basically it's the, our ability to exercise our treaty rights. And so in 1997, the Nez Perce tribe and the U.S. Nez Perce National Forest, you know, we completed dozens of watershed restoration projects throughout the forest. And together we improved riparian areas along with streams by constructing fence lines, protecting over thousands of acres of grazing impacts. We planted over, you know, 30,000 trees along streams and meadow systems, providing shade to streams and homes to wildlife. You know, over 170 miles of roads have been either decommissioned or improved, decreasing sediment production to the streams, you know, and so, and doing undersized culvert replacements. So this has opened up over 50 miles of habitat that was previously inaccessible to aquatic species. And now you think about the stripping of those protections. And then also on top of with the Forest Service, you have Idaho Fish and Game that reduced the water quality standards in the state of Idaho. And then the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho in the lower 48, we have the most pristine headwaters in the lower 48, and yet they want to reduce water quality standards, you know, and that's, you know, through the pressure that they get from higher ups and other industries. You know, industry and recreation and those things take precedence over treaty rights a lot of times. And, you know, we get, but, you know, so we get all these imposed upon us. And so we have to be able to, you know, doing like right now, we're looking at the effects of all this stuff, you know, so, you know, what the logging's doing and, you know, all that inclusive. So, you know, we feel like what the Nez Perce tribe has a 13 national forest agreement that I spoke to you about previously. And, you know, we're one of the only tribes to have that with 13 national forests where they recognize the Nez Perce tribe treaty of 1855 language that allows us access to those national forests. And they signed on to that agreement. And we kind of host an annual meeting each year to discuss these issues. And now that with the new administration forcing upon these, you know, these activities to demolish and diminish this working relationship, you know, puts us in a tough situation as these, you know, because we've already, like I said, I told you before that we had the National Forest Supervisor come to our tribal council the last over 2 weeks ago. And, you know, and so those are some of the things that we're doing strategic planning wise is to make sure that they understand where we're coming from and what we, you know, we want to hear what they're saying as well. So,
okay.
It's important to keep that collaboration, but at the same time, you know, the protection measures and things like that across the landscape are being stripped, and we're going to have to face the onslaught of that, you know, in one way or the other.
Okay. You mentioned your tribe has an agreement with 13 forests in the area. These forests, do they now have land opened up for logging because of this administration directive?
Yes, and that's one of the things that we're looking at, too, is, you know, and we have, like I was saying, we have a short window time frame for reviewing these projects as they come forward, and some of them, you know, some of them have been on the radar for a minute, but at the same time, you know, with the taking away the protection measures and the review processes, it's making it more streamlined for the logging industry to take place and then take precedence over us in terms of protection measures, and that's where you see the hurtful feelings go by the wayside because they don't care about us. You know, they're just going to, it's all in the interest of, you know, they wants to produce, you know, everything that he can to make what he calls America better, but not looking at the bigger picture where you see the diminishment of the landscape, the degradation of the landscape, and the extinction of resources and fish stocks and stuff, things like that, that are most important to us as Indigenous people.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the Indigenous foods that are in those forest lands. Can you talk about some of those foods that Nez Perce people frequently hunt and gather from Nez Perce reservation land and from these other surrounding forest areas?
Yes, thank you for that. And then, you know, fishing was traditionally the important ceremonial subsistence activity for the Nez Perce tribe, along with hunting game. But, you know, the like salmon, plants contributed to the traditional Nez Perce culture in both material and spiritual dimensions. And aside from fishing game, the plant foods provided over half of our dietary calories. You know, the winter survival depended largely upon dried roots, especially cows. When it's fresh, it's and then the cows is when it's peeled and dried. And then we also have tamis or chemis, and that was into those are made in mortars and molded into cakes for future use. Both plants have been traditionally an important food and trade item. And the women were primarily responsible for the gathering and preparing of these roots, root crops. Tamis bulbs are gathered in the region between the Salmon and Clearwater River. You know, some of those places now are being wiped out by, you know, industry and things like that, and farming. We also had favorite fruits we dried for winter were service berries, black huckleberries, red elderberries, choke cherries, you know, and some of the other stuff that Nez Perce textiles that were primarily made from dog mane or camu. Mm-hmm. It's with basically Indian hemp, or tules. We had western red cedar. You know, these are important industrial foods for, you know, red cedar, ponderosa pine, Douglas fir, sandbar willow. But many of the fishes and plants, some of them like the blackberry, are, you know, state symbols, you know, and state fruits, and in the Indian arrowhead and the Douglas fir, things like that are state trees, of, you know, So they themselves, the government and the states, have utilized things that we call first foods that, you know, that are important to us, you know, outside of salmon and that, you know, big game. You know, there's all these little things that are really important to us, especially our the roots and berries. You know, they're really integral to our livelihoods and our ways of life, and going out and providing these activities to go out and look for these roots and berries. You know, it's diminishing as well, you know, especially in the light of industry and, you know, advancement of all these, you know, things that, you know, are outside of the control of the Nez Perce tribe, and we have to deal with it. You know, so losing some of these roots and berries and the first foods is something that we don't want to see happen. And, you know, and that's the thing where, you know, we hear it from our elders, you know, during our general council about, you know, they're taking away these lands in different areas, and we're not able to, you know, be at every single one spot to try to stop the onslaught of diminishing our lands and the roots and berries and the salmon and fishing game, you know. And so that's why it's really... Now more than ever, you know, it's important for us to keep that, you know, in the front of our mind at all times, knowing that, you know, this is happening at a faster rate than ever before. And, you know, and it's all happening in the interest of industry and, you know, and providing, as Trump says, you know, the become the energy power of the region, and, you know, and they're right. Taking that away from the Indigenous people.
Yeah, one part of the directive is to increase timber industry and that part of American economy, and the other part is to decrease wildfire risk. What do you say to that part of this directive from the Trump administration up these lands to decrease wildfire risk?
I'm glad you brought that up. I was talking to one of our Forest Service individuals about 2 weeks ago, and he was talking about all the Forest Service cuts that were primarily seasonal Forest Service workers that were wildland firefighters. And he said over 7,000 of them have been taken off the workforce. And so the U.S. Forest Service was the major arm for fighting wildland fires. And now, you know, and for an example, fires that are happening in Washington now, with the Forest Service, you know, being diminished to the point of just being, you know, not, you know, not a very big fighting force, if you will, in terms of a firefighting workforce. But now that responsibility falls back onto the Department of Natural Resources, Washington DNR. So this year, you know, they were fast tracking to being the major arm for fighting fires, and they've said it on even on the news that, you know, they're going to be strapped for workforce and personnel. And you see the fires happening in Canada right now. They're growing astronomically, and so there's just a big push in that, and Trump doesn't want to hear it with climate change and how that's affecting the overall totality of the new fire regime that's happening out there, and that's the part that, you know, when you take away a major part or a major arm of the fighting force that protects the people and the lands, you know, you're diminishing, you know, the overall fighting force like the way he has. You know, that puts us in a, you know, a precarious situation going forward. And I think that's something that we as the Nez Perce and other tribes are going to have to really, you know, think about that, you know, in a way that, you know, because we used to have a huge wildland firefighting force here on the tribe, but over time, the interest and the lack of funding and other jobs and other things coming into play, you know, we've basically went away from that. And now we, you know, just have engines that patrol and do what they can, but it's not something that's, you know, sustainable to protect the tribe, if you will. You know, so we have to fall back on our relationships with the Idaho Department of Lands, BLM, Bureau of Land Management. So those ones are starting to get diminished as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, so there's some really things that are going to come into firefighting, especially now that it's on our doorstep right now happening, and mm-hmm. we're going to see those effects of that diminishment.
All right. We have just about 30 seconds before we go to another break, but are there already commercial logging companies setting up or planning to start work in forests near your reservation?
Yes, there is. There's, so they have our main Clearwater Nez Perce National Forest office in Kami. I spoke to them after I spoke with you and talked to them yesterday, and they said that they are have a couple of active logging operations ongoing, and they anticipate just through what I explained, you know, previously, that, you know, they're fast tracking a lot of this stuff because of the protection measures and the review process is going out the door, and we're going to be stuck with what they propose going forward.
Okay. All right. We'll be back after this break. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Pride Celebration honoring diversity through Native drum and dance, artistry, resource exchanges, and vendor fare. Trickster Cultural Center's Pride Celebration is open to everyone at no charge June 7th from 2 to 7 p.m. in Schaumburg, Illinois. More under events at TricksterCulturalCenter.org or at 847-301-2090. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at TricksterCulturalCenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The Aleut Marketplace is now open. Aleut Corporation shareholders and registered descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at costcobusinessdelivery.com.
You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular feature on Indigenous food news. I'm Andy Murphy. Do you have an aspiring chef in your family? How many Native students or graduates earn their culinary arts degrees this semester? We'll visit with a future chef about her educational journey at Navajo Technical University's Culinary Arts Program. You can join us too. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Gallup, New Mexico is Nicole Livingston. She's a restaurant manager and she's Diné. Welcome to Native America Calling, The Menu, Nicole.
Hi, good morning. How are you guys doing this morning?
Doing pretty good. I want to bring in one of your instructors also, Brian Tatsukawa, who's also in Gallup, New Mexico. Like I said, he's a culinary arts instructor at the Navajo Technical University. Welcome to The Menu, Brian.
Good morning, Andy. Thank you for having us.
Of course. Nicole, I want to go back to you. First of all, congratulations. You have a couple of certificates in culinary arts from Navajo Tech. I want to ask you first, what prompted you to go into culinary arts? What prompted you to start studying it at Navajo Tech?
Well, I first started culinary arts because I wanted to experience how it would be in a real kitchen. And when I first started to experiment with different recipes, I started to grow a love for food. It was hard to get out of my shell at first at the school, but getting to know my chefs have really helped me build myself, my self-esteem. And my chef Walter and Brian Tatsukawa introduced me to Indigenous foods and how I can add pre-colonial Indigenous to my work. And I started to love it even more because I got to put my culture into my food.
Okay. What are some of your favorite Navajo ingredients you like to use in your food?
Well, I like to use multiple exotic meats like rabbit, duck, basically nothing like pre-colonial stuff, nothing like pork, beef, chicken. We usually stay with what's on our actual land.
Okay, cool. So that would really help you out with an exciting internship you have. Tell us about your internship in Minneapolis coming up.
Well, my internship in Minneapolis, I got this really great opportunity to work with these chefs, and it's a restaurant called Awan Me by Sous Chef. It's a pre-colonial Indigenous restaurant, and I feel like it really fits into what I want to do. And I'm incredibly excited for this internship opportunity because it really helps with what I'm looking for in my food. And I think they really prioritize their goal by purchasing from Indigenous producers. They build menus to reflect the region, culture, and Indigenous food identities. So I'm super excited with what I can learn over there with the chef.
Yeah, that Awan Me is like one of the most renowned, esteemed Indigenous restaurants out there in the country. Chef Sean Sherman has won multiple awards for his work and the restaurant over there. So I think you're going to have a really good addition to your resume by having Awan Me on listed there. What are you most excited about, you know, going into the future now that, you have a couple of certificates, culinary arts certificates under your belt, you're going to be at Awan Me. What's sort of like your career goal, your first career goal after you have all of this, done?
Well, my first career goal, I want to first start my baking business. I've been wanting to do like a little baking business, and I've been wanting to do like an affordable baking business, but it's not going to be, I think it would really help the people out in my community, but also I think that one of my goals before I started culinary arts was wanting to make my way up to Disneyland and be a chef there. But as I'm working into indigenous foods, I still want to figure out where I want to be in that field, because I really like working with indigenous foods and I really want to stick with what I'm doing now.
Okay. When you say affordable, opening up a affordable baking business, do you mean just like offering pastry and bread at a lower price, or, you know, why focus on affordable? Why use that word?
Well, I feel like a lot of people in my community, they don't really have that much financial assistance. So I really want to be out there helping the community with what they can't afford.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, in the beginning of this hour, we talked about SNAP and food insecurity and how that might change in the future. So that would definitely be something that folks would be looking for in the future. I want to go over to Brian. Brian, Nicole is one of about 10 students who graduated this year with their culinary arts degrees. Tell us about the program there at Navajo Technical University. Or tell us what kind of courses these students take as they're getting their culinary arts degrees and certificates.
Currently in Navajo Tech, we have certificates in baking and culinary, as well as associate's degrees. And recently we started a business degree for hotel restaurant management. And throughout, kind of like the underlying theme throughout all of the programs we offer, is much more hands-on than theoretical. So we do our best to utilize books because they contain a great deal of information, but we have them actually execute on what they are learning in the books. So it's everything from, of course, French, as that is the foundation of most restaurants, regardless of what we're doing, as far as like structure, plus knife skills. Most of the students, all the students have to go through rigorous food safety and sanitation training. They will have their certificate, manager certificate, and serve safe, which is a nationally recognized food certification that's required by health departments across the country. And then the usual stuff like sauce production. And then we've begun really trying to incorporate more of the indigenous foods, as we've worked with local purveyors. And then, of course, amazing chefs like Nephi Craig and Andrea Condis.
Okay, cool. How did you guys set up or make that connection between Awami and you know, Nicole? Was that an internship that you guys had to work for, or was it offered to students from Awami?
We had done a competition at Idlewild School in Idlewild, California, and Sean Sherman was there doing the competition. And we just started talking, and he had mentioned that he was really trying to work on opening a restaurant. And then once he was able to, he wanted to work with us to start an internship program. So I think when Nicole goes, we'll be in our fourth year.
Okay.
So it's been a pretty awesome, like, it was coincidental in the beginning, but it's been a really beneficial relationship we've been able to develop since then.
Okay. I went there, was it last year or 2 years ago? And I did meet,
2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. I met a couple of students from Crown Point and Navajo Tech. It was like as soon as I got there, they're like, oh, look, Andy, we have students from Crown Point, from Navajo Tech over here. And it was awesome to see them at work there and then to also, sample almost the entire menu over there. Where have students gone, past culinary arts students gone after they've gotten their degrees from NTU, Brian?
We've had a fair amount of students go on to manage kitchens, like in Death Valley. We had one literally last week just open up her own ice cream business in Texas. A lot of our students really are connected to their community, but they've been able to rise the ranks quickly and start managing BIE food programs at their local BIE schools. So it's been awesome to see how they were still able to find a voice within their community, because of course, you know, our areas, while it is rich in history, it's still pretty much a food desert. You know, there's very limited resources, long distances to travel for supplies. So I think that's been some of the most beneficial things that I've been able to see the students do after they graduate.
Okay. And like you mentioned, there's a lot of hands-on cooking that happens during a lot of the school year and a lot of the classes. Nicole, I want to ask you about your most recent final. It looks like it was a multiple course dinner. Can you tell us about that dinner you made, Nicole?
Yeah, of course. So with my last final, I had to do the 5-course meal. For my appetizer, I did the blue corn bison tamales. I actually made everything by scratch, the masa, the bison. We had to ground that. It wasn't, and then the seasoning. It was really hard to, like, see where we were at on the seasoning and everything. And the salad, I did a zucchini salad served with a herbaceous vinaigrette. And it was just like all of these herbs mixed together with some vinegar, and it was really good. And the soup, I did an acorn squash soup drizzled with olive oil, thyme, and pepitas. I used pepitas so like it can go with the squash and the indigenous theme with how pepitas come with the little, what is it called, the pumpkins that we have here. Mm-hmm. And the first course, I did a rabbit roulade served with wild rice pilaf, and it was topped with mushroom sauce. And the second course was a sous vide duck. I had that sous vide for about 4 hours, and it was so good, nice, juicy, with fondant potatoes. And I did it with yellow squash topped with steak sauce. And then for my dessert, I did a classic with like a blue corn crepe suzette served with a pignon ice cream topped with the orange butter sauce. So I really used my indigenous theme to do all of my courses.
I love that. I hope you start a restaurant somewhere in New Mexico, hopefully in Albuquerque. that sounds like a really good menu already. And that was just a final that you guys regularly have every semester at NTU. But you've also taken part in some other competitions. I was excited to learn about the Chocolate Fantasy event. Can you tell us about that and what you made at that most recent event this year?
Yeah, Chocolate Fantasy. It was actually a really long process. We started from January all the way to, I believe, the due date was around February, but we were like getting all of the stuff ready in December, getting all the chocolate and everything. But we thought we only had a little bit of time, but we actually got everything out on time and working with the chocolate, like tempering it and everything. The sculpture was 100% chocolate. It was 100% edible, but it wasn't recommended to eat it because we dropped multiple pieces.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, we used multiple chocolate, I believe, white, milk, and dark. And we made, the whole theme for Chocolate Fantasy was lights, camera, action. And we were contemplating on our idea. At first, we were going to go with, like, some tapes, some rolling tapes, and some movies, old movies. But we saw that was kind of basic, so we went to a Star Wars theme. And Star Wars didn't really have a red carpet kind of action to it, so mm-hmm. they didn't really get all of the recognition that they should have got. So we decided to do R2-D2 on a red carpet. And we did the Millennium Falcon. We did multiple things. We did the little shooters. It was a really good experience. I really loved it, like putting what we loved into our sculpture.
Right.
And for that one, we won first choice for the People's Choice and second place for our chocolate bonbons. Our chocolate bonbons, we did white chocolate pinon sumac ganache with roasted fried Hatch green chili. It was super good. It had, like, it was light vanilla, and then it would turn green chili so spicy.
Okay. All right. That sounds really good. I have to make it to the next Chocolate Fantasy competition here in Albuquerque. But that is all the time we have for our discussion today. I'd like to say thank you to all of our guests. We just heard from Nicole Livingston, Brian Tatsukawa, Eric Holt, and Kelly Case. Join us next week for another lineup of discussions about Indigenous issues and topics. I'm Andy Murphy.
We have a fisherman's meeting, a preseason meeting coming right up here in about 5 minutes or so. So stay tuned, folks, and I hope everything goes all right. It should. We'll have it on our website if you miss it. And where am I here? There it is.
That's AMERICORPS.gov/VISTA. Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite.